Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hi, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in East European Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Steven Siegel, and I'm coming to you from the Rocky Mountains, and I'll be your host today for our interview with Professor Emanuela Grama, who is an associate professor at Carnegie Mellon University, and she has just published a book called Socialist Heritage, The Politics of Past and Place in Romania, published by Indiana University Press in 2019. A little bit about Professor Grama. She is Associate Professor of History, Anthropology, and Anthropology in the History Department at Carnegie Mellon University. She received her PhD from the Interdisciplinary Program in Anthropology and History at the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor. She conducted extensive archival and ethnographic research in different locations in Romania, and she's drawn on this research to write articles about the nationalization of art in early socialism, the politics of archaeology and nationalism, nationalization, petitions, intertextuality and citizenship, and plagiarism in post-socialism. So welcome to Emanuela Grama today.
Thank you, Stephen. It's really a pleasure for me to be here.
So I want to start by asking about this beautifully produced book on socialist heritage. Could you begin by telling our listeners what it's about?
Sure. So the title actually is has a double meaning. So first of all, I'm writing about the socialist state in post-45 Romania. And I am looking at the ways in which the state officials, together with a set of experts, including historians as well as archaeologists, tried to ground this radically new political project of basically building socialism, literally and symbolically, in a very particularly designed past. So I'm looking on one hand at the production of the heritage for the socialist regime, and specifically the ways in which state officials, together with these particular experts, try to find specific historical periods, especially the medieval times, to use this medieval time as a sign of a Romanian nation, but also to anchor the socialist present in this medieval past. So that would be one dimension of what the socialist heritage stands for. The second is the it's basically referring to the legacy of the socialist project, that is, what happened after the end of the communist regime in December 1989, when allegedly there was a significant rupture with the previous regime and promised new democracy and freedom. So by looking at what was the legacy of the socialist regime that ended in 89, I'm also exploring the particular continuities between visions of you know, political order, as well as very particular continuities among between the former elites and the post 1989 economic and political elites. So those who allegedly lost power and those who gain power. So that's the double meaning of the title of the book.
I find it really interesting throughout the book how you explore all of the meanings and implications of heritage. So there's a lot written on this by historians and anthropologists. Can you give us an idea of what you would define heritage as for a working definition or for its many implications in the history of communist Romania?
So I will start basically with a concept first. So I actually make a conscious choice of using heritage and not patrimony, precisely because I'm starting by looking at the etymology of the two words. So what's fascinating about both words, patrimony and heritage, is that they emerged somewhere in the 14th century, 13th centuries. But the two words that are now seem to be used interchangeably, at that moment represented two distinct relations. So one, patrimony comes from the from pater, right, from father. So it really highlights the origins of one the origins of one thing, be that material thing or a certain kind of tradition. So it really focuses on the origins. Heritage has in its etymology the idea of her, right? So the destination. What's fascinating to me about this distinction is that whereas there is an assumption that patrimony is only about the past, that is symbolically the pater, right, the father, heritage already has in its own etymology the implicit highlight of a relation, so a relationship between the past, the father, and the present, and therefore it's a conscious choice that I make to use heritage. It's a burgeoning literature right now about what heritage is. It's not only about material things. It's not only about historic monuments or historic sites. It's more about various ways in which groups, individuals, states, nation states, even regions try to ground themselves into a very particular design past. And this is where I'm actually also placing myself and my theoretical approach in the ways in which there are very particular agendas informed by contemporary political interests that make this polities, individuals, group try to call upon processes happening in the past to gain a legitimacy in the present. In the context of Romania, I'm looking particularly, again, the ways in which basically we're talking about a new state, a new regime is trying to gain visibility and also legitimacy from the population in the aftermath of the Second World War by calling upon a very particular past. I alluded earlier that I'm talking about specifically the medieval past. What's particular about the medieval past is that they were referring to specifically was the concept of feudalism. So in the context of a Marxist, or rather a very simplified Marxist approach to history, we have to understand that the socialism as a specific political and economic stage could not happen had not been for the previous existence of the feudal relations of productions. So by trying to seek a proof of this particular so-called feudal past, the socialist experts, such as archaeologists and historians, were trying to justify the legitimacy of the socialist project.
And I think in your focus on heritage as historical preservation, I want to ground the story now in Old Town Budapest. So in reading your book and especially in reading the introduction, I was absolutely dazzled and impressed by the kinds of historical accounts that you studied and the wide variety of research, starting with archival research, but also including ethnographic fieldwork you did. I mean, this includes interviewing taxi drivers and studying phone books. That's an absolutely, I think, interesting way of going about the path to urban history and the path to studying how political elites use and abuse historical preservation. So can you talk about how you were drawn to this?
So the old town in Bucharest, in Romania's capital, we are talking about a district that has a fascinating history. So this is a district that emerged in the 17th century. Initially, this was the site of a medieval palace that was built by a Wallachian. At that moment, we are talking about Wallachia. Romania did not exist as a nation state at that moment. So a Wallachian prince the end of the 17th century. And given the emergence of this palace, it automatically triggered a much more intense economic exchange. What happened with, and the palace eventually was eventually burned, and the decision for the other rulers, the rulers in the 18th century, was to move the site of the palace up the hill. So this became what was called the Old Court. So it was really the ruined former court of the former palace, which was actually cut into different pieces of land and actually given to various merchants. So the court disappeared, but the district actually flourished, and it became the old town. But it was really a hub of various ethnicities, economic categories, and it was one of the districts that eventually merged to form modern Bucharest.
And would you say that there was a specific form of socialist modernity? And in particular, as you talk about the urban visions in Bucharest and how it was made into a socialist capital, were there architects who thought very consciously about erasing the past? I know you developed this idea of a kind of neo-medieval revival versus the socialist modernity. Can you talk about that?
Sure. So the book starts with some debates, closed-door debates, between the members of the Politburo, that is basically the central officials of the Communist Party, and particular architects who were commissioned to develop a new socialist master plan. So they had to really come up with a very particular vision of how to transform Bucharest into a modern socialist city. And what they were facing were two main they were very optimistic about it, but at the same time, they were facing two main limitations. One was resources. Well, actually three. It was the question of resources. It was the question of time. They had to provide housing on rather relatively quickly to an increasing number of people moving to Bucharest to search for work. And then the third limitation was expertise. So they definitely had this highly optimistic, highly radical vision of what Bucharest should look like as a modern socialist city. At the same time, they knew that they were confronting with the post-war Bucharest, which they totally despise. One of the Politburo members actually described Bucharest as a spider web with very narrow, intricate streets that were really representing really a symbol of economic and social disorder. So they really wanted both the architects and the socialist state officials wanted to bring order into the city. That was the idea of socialist modernity. It's also important to understand that their promise and their vision at the same time was really denying any previous attempts of bringing order into the city that had already been pursued by architects and city officials, especially during the interwar era. One of the main concerns for this team of architects and state officials was the city center. So they were aware that the city center, which also included the Old Town District, represented this so-called spider web of narrow streets. And they initially thought that they can really put this to the ground and totally raise it and reconstructing it into a modern, optimistic, as one architect put it, city center. But very soon they realized that they didn't have either the resources, the money to do so, the time or the experts to be able to do that. So in a way, even though they profoundly despise the Old Town with all this very problematic architecture and streets that they saw as the epitome of anti-modernity, at the same time, they had to immediately realize that they had to find a way to keep it and perhaps alter it by systematically and during a much longer period of time.
Yeah, and I'll read a passage because I think you capture the role of specialists and experts and managers well. And it's on page 74 in the second chapter. When you talk about this quarrel between the architects and archaeologists, you write, "The tug of war between the architects and the archaeologists," this is the early 1950s and early 1960s, "over the political and historical value of the old court revealed in part a complex struggle for political and institutional visibility in the socialist system. Those competing agendas triggered frustrations among each group of stakeholders. The architects had to comply with the requirement that archaeological research be carried out before any further architectural intervention could be undertaken in the city center. The archaeologists, on the other hand, felt pressed to get their work done at an impossible pace, and sometimes they may have even been strategically disinvited," I love this, "from beginning an excavation." So it seems to me that there are a lot of silences here in addition to the tug of war. Can you talk a little about that?
Yes. Well, so what was very particular about the pursuit of the modernization of Bucharest in starting basically with late 40s, early 50s, was that for the very first time, the archaeologists were allowed to dig in the city center. Before, there were never archaeological excavations pursued in the city center. So archaeologists found this as an amazing opportunity to be able to learn more about the history of the city. at the same time, they also knew that their role was rather temporary. They had to do their job very quickly in order to allow the architects to basically use the ground to build up the new city, the new socialist city. What was particular about the old town, was that the archaeologists knew of the existence of the old court. So in 1949, 1950s, the old court did not exist. It was buried in the ground. And they had already an information about the existence of the old court from a 1495 charter. And they were really trying to see if they can find some of the walls, so a certain kind of material proof of the old court. And they did find these walls. So once they found some of the walls, this is when the so-called the conflict emerged between the architects and the archaeologists. Speaking of silences, I think what I'm thinking about silence is that more of the secondary role that archaeologists were assigned by the state officials, but also the ways in which they view themselves in the hierarchy of expertise niches of expertise in the context of a centralized regime of power. I'm talking about the socialist state. And the archaeologists, once they found a part of the walls of the old court, they hang onto these walls as,
right,
you know,
right.
important, suddenly very, very important, proof of their suddenly valuable expertise for the political purpose.
And that particular point about materiality, the social life of things, as Arjun Appaduri put it once, it becomes extremely important because, correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems that proof has to acquire some kind of material being. It is proof that one can go back to a historic date and then commemorate it, but the materiality of the historical culture and preservation becomes absolutely important, especially if for those who are archaeologically minded.
Yes, indeed. So this is one of my my arguments. What I'm saying is that archaeologists were able to justify their political importance for a regime that really very much was grounded, right theoretically, in what Marx called dialectical materialism. So there was a sense that a profound materiality was what represented the truth. And they did never, and the archaeologists especially, and I'm not talking about only archaeologists in Romania, it was really very much a pattern, especially in the Central and Eastern Europe. They really wanted to use archaeological artifacts because they claimed to be much more valid than historical documents, written documents, because they were thinking, they were claiming that such historical documents were somehow too subjective, that they were really produced within what they were calling a bourgeois historiography. And they never really talked about the fact that also an object, right, it is a form of a text. I mean, it is imbued with meaning at different moments. Those meanings can change according to also different moments. So they never really wanted to underscore the very subjectivity of what an archaeological artifact can also represent.
Yeah, and I think I see that especially in the nationalization campaign of the 1960s, when there is this very dramatic transformation of Old Town, of the historic district. And I think what happens in many ways is a loss, that there is a geography of loss for the multi-ethnic pre-war, interwar history of Jewish, Armenian, Italian, German, Hungarian, Greek populations. So how does that ethnic homogenization, that nationalization proceed, especially in the 1960s, but maybe even before or after that?
So the ethnic homogenization happens in parallel to what I discuss in relation to the reemergence of the old court as a proof of the Romanian nation. So most of the Romanian Jews that actually are still that have survived the Holocaust and they have survived the war have been trying to migrate to first Palestine and then after 1948 to Israel. And Israel found a way to negotiate with the Romanian communists to allow the Romanian Jews to leave. So between 1955 and 1960, there is this continuous negotiation between Israel and the Communist Romanian Party. And finally, in the 1960s, the Stolz officials finally agree officially to let the Romanian Jews to emigrate. For instance, Dej, who was at that moment the leader of the party, said specifically, if they want to leave, we have to let them leave, because otherwise the international press will still consider us, call us the prison of people. So the effect on the old town is profound, precisely because many business owners were of Jewish origins. This is one of the reasons I use the phone books who were the people living there, because there is very few data specifically about the old town. And so I had to be very creative to find a way to get more and more information about this place by looking at various alternative sources of data. So there is this significant immigration happening already 1955, 1960. We are talking about a decade or so, many people are leaving from the city center, from the Jewish quarter, and also from the old town.
Yeah. Go ahead.
So what I'm saying is there are two parallel processes. But what's very important about the so-called ethnic homogenization happening in the 60s and especially in the 70s is that the emigration of the Jews, of the Romanian Jews, Bucharest Jews, is also complemented by this new attention given by the state officials, by the local officials, to the old court as a sign of the nation, as a material sign of the nation. So there are two distinct processes that somehow converge and become to be used politically by the same state officials.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
I'm especially interested in the question of data, and I'll come back to that, especially, let's say, after the recession of 2007-2008. I'm interested in when, this is going to be sound like a very innocent question, but with all of this kind of boosterism and promotion of the old town as historically European, how is it that the political elite stakeholders, as you describe them from the 60s forward, begin to draw distance spatially from Moscow? Is it a simple nationalization process? Have you found evidence in paper form, in written form, of a broader agenda to kind of make Budapest European? How would you describe that process?
So Bucharest,
I'll read a passage. You say at one point in talking about the Europeanness of Bucharest, so in the context of mid-60s Romania, the new insistence on historic preservation must also be put in the context of the government's attempt to keep Moscow at arm's length while focusing on its national affairs and seeking a relative economic rapprochement with Western countries. So the promoters, you feature them a lot, these stakeholders, these experts, these managers. How do they begin to draw distance from Moscow, from the Kremlin? When does that exactly happen?
So what is fascinating is that if we look at official political decisions, often this kind of distance from Moscow will be placed as part of the thaw, especially after 1958. For instance, a political scientist, Vladimir Tismanano, talks about Gheorghiu Udej as actually launching his own form of so-called local Stalinism by during the thaw. So basically Tismanano is actually arguing that Dej launched his own attempt to take this distance from Moscow by forging new economic relations with the West, especially, or for instance, opening a new economic agreement with West Germany. But what's fascinating is that if we are looking at the debates that seem to be apolitical at the first glance, such as the discussion about the modernization of Bucharest, we can see in the discussions between architects and political leaders, including Dej, the fact that they were less and less inclined to rely on Soviet experts and Soviet advice. So, it is already a moment that actually foreshadows later political obvious developments in this kind of discussions in which, for instance, they are saying, well, if we really need experts, let's not really look exclusively to Soviet architects, but let's rather try to find local architects. And they do, and they actually what they do is they even decide to appeal to older architects who, from their perspective, were somehow tainted politically, right? They had they were associated with bourgeoisie, with the interwar middle class. And at one moment, they are actually specifically talking about very important architects in one of the state officials says, oh, we despise him as a landowner, but we definitely value him as an architect. So they are definitely realizing they would rather work with local experts rather than actually working with Soviet architects. So this is one interesting aspect of push for a form of autonomy, relative autonomy. What's important about the mid-60s, again, is that we are still talking about the political thaw, right, following in the post-Stalin era. And this is also the moment where you see in different archives that there is a constant interest of the Romanian state and the Romanian Communist Party to approach various kinds of institutions and states in Western Europe. For instance, they also appeal to UNESCO to gain some funds to launch various kinds of projects of various kinds of agricultural projects. So they gain these funds from UNESCO. There is also this, as I said, this new economic treaties signed between Romania and France and Germany. So there is definitely a clear interest in trying to still portray themselves as very much part of the Soviet bloc, but at the same time trying to reconnect to Western European institutions and states.
Is there a particular point in time in the 80s or 90s maybe when property is devalued, and in all of your interviews with ordinary people, which you cover throughout the book, is there a point where people become and actually understand that they're sort of powerless? I think the powerlessness is so palpable in understanding the role of property and dispossession throughout the book. So could you give a kind of historical overview of that sense? It's really more like a feeling, but I think throughout the 80s and 90s and then beyond that, there's a really deep ambivalence about the commercialization of Old Town and the loss of the old socialist property regime.
So the Old Town, most of the businesses in the Old Town were nationalized, right? They became state property. What was very particular also about the emigration of the Romanian Jews from the Old Town was that often for many of them, in order to receive a passport and an exit visa, they were signing off their apartments to the state. So these apartments became state property. So this is yet another less known wave of a very particular form of nationalization. So the Old Town during the communist time was often, I did not find any specific data about which places, which apartments, which buildings were privately owned. It's very unlikely that one particular building was really owned by anyone else but the state. In the after 1989, the people who had these businesses and apartments nationalized during 1948, the official nationalization of private property, started pursuing. They tried to get them back, and they filed petitions after petitions after petitions to the state officials to recognize that the nationalization was now moot and that this property should actually be given back to the former owners. What happened is, unfortunately, that these petitions often went just unanswered. Property restitution had been in the 90s, especially, and very much throughout 2000, a very controversial topic. And we are talking about hundreds of thousands of petitions that had been still unsolved by the state officials.
Wow. That's so incredible. That's an incredible thing. Sorry, go ahead, please.
It's important also to know that one of the conditions for Romania's inclusion in the EU, during the negotiations before its inclusion in 2007, property restitution was a key point that the European officials and various other Western states were trying to pressure and trying to really diplomatically persuade the Romanian state officials that they have to become very serious about property restitution. Otherwise, their inclusion into the EU might be postponed again.
Yeah, and you say that, if I can read a passage again about Old Town in the 1990s, it's striking to me, this impact of privatizations at the end of your chapter 4. You write, the rapid degradation of the old town in the 1990s, alongside the booming privatization and the new banks, offer a poignant picture of the broader processes of value-making and unmaking following the end of the communist regime. The political elites of the quote-unquote wild and blurry 1990s strategically used the shabbiness of the district to turn it as much as possible into an abjected space, denying its colorful history and its defiant sociology. No longer a heritage site for the socialist state, the district became portrayed as an allegedly ahistorical place populated by two contrasting categories, squatters and bankers, people without history and people who wanted to erase their own history so that they could keep their tight hold on power. I wonder if you could comment on that.
So one of my arguments when I'm actually tracing the distinct meanings and values associated with the old town or different political moments is that in the 90s, what's very particular about the old town is that it somehow left frozen in time. There are specific attempts to intervene in the old town. I'm actually speaking, talking at length in the book about this collaboration between British architects, a team of British architects and a team of Romanian architects who tried with funds from the British government to bring some know-how and expertise not only restoring the facades of the historical buildings, but trying to bring new visibility to the district by trying to organize street festivals, trying to really add new value. Basically, one of the British architects who was part of that team told me that, well, in order for a place to gain value, you cannot really start by really redoing the infrastructure. That will take far too much time. It's like as if putting lipstick for a place to look prettier. And once it looks prettier, people will believe it's pretty and they will start coming back. These kind of attempts were totally denied by, at that time, the city hall officials on the justification that the place is already on the border of collapsing, that there is no value about these historic buildings. And the way how I interpret this denial of assistance is that I'm using the expression of strategic disregard to talk about how, in fact, while denying any further attempt to intervene in the old town and making more valuable, at the same time, the city officials associated with the city hall were really trying to keep it undervalued as a way to really siphon off resources for themselves. The old town really kept coming back in the news and in the media, in the newspapers, in Bucharest, the national dailies, but no one really, besides investigative journalists, no one really talked about doing something about the old town up to basically the early 2000s.
Yeah, and you have wonderful stories about your quests for data. And this includes things like the number of privately owned houses or residents, things that are would seem to be readily available if you're coming in and doing historical research, but you can't find them. And so how do you relate to that if you're not being sort of supplied with accurate information as a researcher?
Well, so I grew up in Romania. When I started really doing research around this topic, I knew very well that it's going to be a very difficult topic, especially in the context of this very profound tensions around the issue of property restitution. So once property became such a profoundly political topic, data suddenly disappeared. If they had ever been there, they suddenly disappeared. So I actually talk in the book at length about how I tried various institutions knocking at different doors to look for specific information about who lived in the old town, when, which apartments are still owned by the state, which apartments were now regained back by the former owners. And definitely I got nothing. Some people were actually extremely direct about telling me, who do you think you are, to ask for this kind of information. I also had to really ask around for various kinds of people who had been associated to various kinds of state institutions and who had then done their own research. So I tried to really put together a very heterogeneous array of data. One very interesting episode for me was this encounter with a geographer who had already been able to gain access to some data specifically about the district, particularly about the state own apartments in the district. And what was fascinating about that table that I actually copied from his own computer was that at one moment, you can see a decrease in the number of state-owned properties in the district, which is basically, in a way, logically makes sense, right? I mean, the idea was that property restitution was an important condition for Romania to gain access to the EU. Therefore, the Romanian politicians had to mobilize themselves and really start actually finally give back these properties. But at one moment, I think somewhere in the mid-90s, I have to look again at the book, suddenly there is an increase in the number of the state-owned properties in the district. So I was trying to make sense of how come this decrease followed by this increase. And so when I was talking to this geographer, he actually gave me a fascinating story about invisible state properties. There is a long story in the book about how these properties somehow they were kept invisible,
right,
by specific city officials who were no longer interested to show them that they were actually properties owned by the state.
It's a great story, and you have marvelous photos. Actually, I think from your 2016. Trip where you're showing the red dot building, for example, or these sort of interiors. How would you describe the EU sort of policy of Europeanization in Old Town Bucharest? Looking back from, let's say, the standpoint of, or the perspective of these experts, what Catherine Verdery called entrepratchiks, like somewhere between entrepreneurs and operatchiks since the 1990s.
Yes, I think it's important to make though this distinction between the experts and the entrepreneurs.
I can't even say it.
Yeah, because what she's saying is basically see how the former politicians, right, the key power holders of the communist regime, managed to keep their power and become these entrepreneurs of the 90s, right, of the post-communist era. So they were able to really capitalize on their former political capital to gain enormous amount of wealth in the 90s and 2000s. So there is clear a distinction between the experts and this very particular category of entrepreneurs as politicians or as former politicians. In the context of Europeanization, so what's interesting about the trope of Europeanization is that it's becoming again used, especially in 2000, when we are talking about a different government coming, gaining power, that is the Democrat party. They are definitely political faction that definitely promote privatization. So whereas before the 90s, we talk about a government that was really calling upon the nation to really keep the borders closed to foreign investment of capital so that they find a way to really gain as much wealth as possible by actually distributing and redistributing and devaluing very important properties and very important industries. The new political faction that comes to power in the 2000s is saying, well, we are definitely pro-European, we are definitely interested in finally gaining access to the European Union, and Europeanization is really becoming a key target for both the city officials as well as for the Romanian government. So in the context of the Old Town becomes suddenly again valuable. Right. In the 90s, it was considered to be an abject place. And I argue why it was considered to be an abject place, precisely to keep its value as low as possible. In the 2000s, it suddenly really looked upon as an example of the former cosmopolitan, that is European history, that is the pre-1945 history of the city. And they use it as a way of gaining more funds, actually, from the European Union to invest in the city.
Right. I see that with the gentrification projects, especially that continue to go on. My last question before I ask you about your current research is, in recent years, people have paid attention again to Romania following the protests in 2018. So how do you see this heritage? You describe it at one point as a kind of fluid or millennial fluid heritage, now being leveraged in the neoliberal city, for lack of a better phrase, among the propertied, where not just the underclass is dispossessed, but actually ordinary citizens are dispossessed as well and rendered quite invisible. But what is it that future researchers can focus on in order to understand the subtle changes of that kind of heritage?
Well, when I talk about fluid heritage, I actually refer to the fact that increasingly heritage is becoming a trope for various kinds of groups to really try to, as I said, right, gain more political visibility and therefore gain, hopefully, more political rights. In the case of Romania, especially in the contemporary Romania, late 2010s, heritage is still very much looked upon, especially when I'm talking about the state officials and the city officials, as yet another way to gain political capital for themselves. So what happens, for instance, in the Old Town? I'm actually talking at length about these historic buildings where there are state tenants living there. Some of them, they were born there and they have actually been living there since birth. The buildings are totally neglected by the city hall. The city hall says, well, if they have, if they have the means, they should restore the buildings themselves, even though they are state tenants. At the same time, the same city officials are definitely interested in restoring some other sites. But what's important is that they actually try to restore some other sites as long as the money for the restoration comes from abroad. One of the very interesting cases is, for instance, the very recent restoration of a famous historical inn in the Old Town, but the money came from, in fact, European Union via the Scandinavian states, including Norway. So we are basically talking about 20 million euro that were channeled specifically to so-called cultural heritage projects. So at the same time, the Romanian officials are actually using this to actually create capital and visibility for themselves, to in fact reinforce their own power.
Wow, that's an incredible story. And there are so many other stories of corruption. It doesn't even begin to describe it. in this wonderful book, it corruption is actually a euphemism that we shouldn't use after reading this wonderfully researched book. So could you tell us, Professor Grama, what you're working on right now? What are your new projects?
So if this project was very much, right, a story about the making, the and building up of a form of nationalism through this heritage trope. What I'm looking at right now is the relationship between the ethnic Germans, especially the Transylvanian ethnic Germans in Romania in post 45. And I'm looking at how Romanian state tried to retaliate against the ethnic Germans by confiscating the property confiscating their houses and land, and then played a kind of a cat and mouse game with the ethnic Germans throughout the entire socialist times by giving them back the property, then taking it back, offering them, not allowing them to emigrate, and so on. So I'm looking at that to understand how the very few left ethnic Germans right now in Romania are still trying to keep political visibility as a way to still claim back the property that had been initially confiscated in 1945 by the Romanian state. By doing so, I'm also looking at how they also appeal to transnational organizations such as the European Union, as well as Germany and other Western European states, in actually asking them to help with various kinds of property claims.
That sounds like an incredible project, and I love the transnational focus, of course. So I want to thank you for joining us. We've been speaking with Professor Emanuela Grama about her new book. It's a brilliant book called Socialist Heritage: The Politics of Past and Place in Romania. The book is published by Indiana University Press in 2019. And I'm Stephen Siegel, and you've been listening to New Books in East European Studies. I want to thank Emanuela Grama for joining us today.
Thank you so much, Stephen. I really appreciate it.